When the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor in December of 1941, a series of events were set into motion that resulted in Japanese-American citizens on the West Coast being forcibly interned in camps. And we've said ever since that that could never happen again. Yet today, in the wake of Paris, San Bernardino, Donald Trump, Cleveland, Chicago, Santa Rosa, and on, we see that we still must actively resist the profiling that leads to loss of civil rights of American citizens in their own country. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Today we feature Kermit Roosevelt, the great-great-grandson of the 26th President of the United States, Teddy Roosevelt, with his novel Allegiance, a legal thriller embroiled in the Supreme Court rulings that let stand Franklin Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066, which authorized the relocation of persons of Japanese descent. Later in the broadcast, we'll talk with Larry Hendricks of Oakland Firefighters Random Acts, an organization devoted to giving back to firefighters and the communities they serve. Their current project partners with the Fire Family Foundation to support the over 30 firefighters who lost their homes in the Valley Fire in Lake County and the Butte Fire in Calaveras. So stay with us. It's A Novel Idea. Kermit Roosevelt, aside from being related to Teddy, is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, has many, many legal publications, has represented a detainee at Guantanamo Bay, and is also the author of a couple of novels, In the Shadow of the Law, and his most recent book, Allegiance. Let's listen to our conversation. Kermit Roosevelt, welcome to Sonoma County.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Allegiance, your latest novel, places one man, Caswell Harrison, Cash, at the nexus of historical events, which actually continue to have repercussions today, and they really continue to challenge our country's ideals. And part of what the book has to do with is the internment of American citizens of Japanese descent and how this played out in the courts, the transformation of government and the courts under the presidency of Franklin Roosevelt, and the relationship of the military to the judicial and executive, along with the growing tentacles of the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover, who is a sweet little character in your book. And all of this is the evolution of Cash as he goes from kind of a debutante dating dandy who has a real zeal to serve the country, but he fails the physical and gets a pretty good gig at Supreme Court as a clerk, moves on to the Justice Department where he also gets a good gig and eventually is serving by representing Japanese who are just about to be sent back to Japan. So that's setting up the story a bit. And we're going to talk about the book. But I think we really need to first talk about the implications today that this have. Because also threaded through the book, you have learning from the past. Yet here we are with the shootings in Paris, and we're still just in the raw wake of what happened in San Bernardino County. And we are seeing right now, in real time, not fiction, that there's talk of really approaching our own citizens of Islamic descent and practicing Muslims, of characterizing them and maybe restricting some of their rights. And so can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, what we're seeing now is a pattern that occurs over and over again through American history. Something happens that scares us, and we react in fear. We react by trying to identify the threat. And if it's hard to figure out who the dangerous people are, we often focus on people who are different from us, particularly if in some way they resemble the people who attacked us. That's what happened after Pearl Harbor. It's what happened after September 11th. You see the same reaction now. And in a sense, there's nothing we can do about that because it's a natural human reaction. We can't change the fact we're human beings. We're wired a certain way. That's the way our psychology works. What we can do maybe is look to the past to understand what this reaction leads us to do, because we overreact. We commit injustices. We tend to regret them after the fact. We say perhaps it will never happen again. Sometimes we even change our laws to ensure that it won't happen again. But we do have this same psychological reaction. And the thing that we can do now, I hope, is we can look at other examples of this in the past. We can learn what not to do. We can actually do better in the future.
And it seems like we are, for the most part, we condemn and feel a great deal of shame for how we treated Japanese Americans in the wake of Pearl Harbor. Yet we have kind of strange presidential season, and now the internment of Japanese in World War II is almost looked at as precedent for, look, we did this in a positive way. Like, we did this before. Maybe we need to do it again. And it seems like some of the events of your book, the Supreme Court maybe had an opportunity there to respond differently. And how can our government, and I don't know, you may not know the answer to this, but it's a question out there to the universe. How can we as a culture, as a society, as a democracy respond?
It's a challenge for a democracy. It's a challenge for the American people. I think if you think about what the government can do, there's one answer. If you think about what the people can do, there's another answer. So with respect to the government, I don't think that we're ever going to get a president of either party who is going to avoid this kind of mistake, because the president is supposed to act decisively. The president feels a very strong responsibility to protect America. The president is the one who's going to go out there and push the limits and say, I will do what it takes to keep this country safe. Who's going to stop the president? In our system of government, it's the judges. The judiciary is supposed to stop the executive from trampling on individuals' rights in the name of national security. And the Supreme Court failed to do that during World War II. They failed in the Korematsu case, where they said it was okay for the government to make the Japanese Americans leave their homes. But I think the Supreme Court learned from that experience. And if you look at the post-9/11 cases, where the Bush administration is saying basically the same thing, you know, we'll do whatever it takes to keep America safe, in some cases the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. So I think our government actually is dealing with this kind of situation a little bit better in terms of the interaction between the courts and the president. And then the other thing is, I hope that the American people have learned something. Because if you don't have a public that's afraid, that's clamoring for action, that is saying, do something to these scary people, even if maybe they're not dangerous, do something to keep these different people away from me. If we can avoid that reaction at the level of the individual, then you don't get as much pressure on the government to commit these kinds of overreactions and injustices.
It was remarkable to me how swiftly those actions took place after December 7th, a day that lives in infamy. Within a matter of months, people were taken out of their homes and put into holding centers or into camps. Just remarkable. So I want to just remind our listeners that Kermit Roosevelt is the great, great, great grandson of Teddy Roosevelt?
The great-great-grandson of Teddy Roosevelt.
Of Teddy Roosevelt. Yes. But you're also a law professor, and I think that is, just from what you were just talking, probably pretty evident. And you have written, it seems like you have written a whole bunch of stuff, but this is your second novel, yes?
Yes.
And what is that that drives you to – is it just that the reality of it all is just so colorful you have to put it into a novel, or that it's a forum for expressing ideas that maybe don't easily fit into another venue? Or is it just fun?
I think my first simplest answer is it's fun. I just love to write. I love to tell stories. I've always been fascinated by storytelling and literature. But the other thing is that, yes, there is a sort of educational component to what I'm trying to do. So my first novel, In the Shadow of the Law, is sort of a sociological examination of life in a law firm. And I wrote that because I thought it might actually help some of my students or other law students who are going on to work in big law firms. It might help them retain their identities or retain their sanity and not surrender to the kind of identity that big firms try to foist on people. You know, they try to tell you who you are. They try to tell you what's important. And it's possible to have a decent life as a lawyer in a big law firm if you can remember who you are and what's important to you. So that was the first novel. Allegiance, I was trying to explore the question of what we do in times of national insecurity, because it did seem to me that there's this predictable pattern. We get afraid, we overreact, we commit injustices, then we regret them. And you can write that down, and you can write it in a law review article. I write law review articles. And you can make an argument about it. But first, not a lot of people read law review articles. And second, there are certain things that maybe you can convince people of by argument, maybe you can't. The change that we need to see in the American people, though, is not really being convinced of some particular logical proposition or some particular argument. We need the American people to have more empathy, to lose less of their empathy in times of fear. We need the American people to do a better job at distinguishing those who are different from those who are dangerous. And that kind of transformation is not really a matter of convincing people about particular points. It's a matter of changing the way that they view the world. And that's something that I think fiction can do, but legal or logical argument really can't, because we make sense of the world through stories. We organize our own experience. We understand our own lives through stories and narratives. And by telling people a story, you can affect the way that they think about the world.
And your character, your main character in the book, his nickname is Cash. He starts out, I think, a little naive, but he picks up speed pretty fast. He learns a little bit about women, but he seems to conquer his own fear and seems unintimidated by J. Edgar Hoover. So tell me a little bit about Cash.
Well, there were a couple of things I was trying to do with this character. One was I was trying to show the evolution of someone who starts out thinking that the government is always the good guy, sort of identifying the government with America. He loves his country. He loves his government. He thinks his government is going to do the right thing because, after all, they're the good guys. And then he starts to understand the government is fallible. The government can make mistakes. And then maybe when the government makes a mistake, they don't want to admit it, so they lie to cover it up. And he starts to understand that really, if we're going to be a good country, if we're going to be a good people, we have to be better than the government sometimes. So allegiance to America, allegiance to the Constitution, doesn't necessarily mean blindly following the government. That's one of the things that happens. The other thing is he starts to understand a bit more what life is like for people who are different from him. He starts out with a very sheltered background. He comes from this very insular Philadelphia society where what goes on in Philadelphia is important and what goes on in the rest of the country or the rest of the world, people don't care as much about. And he starts to understand that those are real people out there, even if they look different, even if they have a different religion or a different language. And what happens to them counts just as much as what happens to people in his inner circle.
And that whole thing of we're the good guys, I think that phrase came up several times in the book of we're the good guys. I saw that was something that everybody was dealing with to a certain extent. The judges were dealing with that. The people in the camps were dealing with that. Also, that whole Philadelphia thread, that there was a camaraderie, an allegiance between those people of a certain class, from a certain background, which turned out to be something he couldn't abide by or he didn't have allegiance to. And for those of us on the West Coast, what about that whole Philadelphia thing?
Well, I chose Philadelphia as his hometown for a couple of reasons. One is that's where I live, and I like to write about Philadelphia. So this allowed me to set some of the book in places that were very familiar to me. I also chose it because Philadelphia society at the time did have this kind of insularity. It very much was a city that viewed itself sort of in opposition to the rest of the country. One of the characters says, you know, Philadelphia doesn't really know what it is. It just knows that it's not New York or it's not Washington. And here in Philadelphia, that's what's important. That's what we care about. So there was that. And then it also turned out, almost coincidentally, almost to my surprise, that there really were a lot of people from Philadelphia who played a big role in these events. And so as I kept on going on and I kept on uncovering more Philadelphians, I thought it would be interesting if I kind of played up that thread and made that something that was important to them, because it also works in with the themes of the book, which are, where should you place your allegiance? How do you decide whose interests count, who's important, who you can trust? And so starting out with a world in which the Philadelphians felt this very strong bond to each other just because they're all from Philadelphia made it easy to develop those ideas.
A lot of the characters in the book are real characters in history. And I think that must be a tricky thing to write about when you're characterizing Supreme Court justices and when there's murder involved. And it got me actually going to check out, is this a real character? Did that really happen? And so much of it was based in fact. And so how do you approach that with, for instance, it seems like Charles Fahey, the Solicitor General of the United States at the time, apparently did suppress evidence. So how do you decide when you're pushing it too far with real characters in history? And you might have a sensitivity, I mean, with the history of your own family being involved as well.
It's difficult in some ways to write historical fiction because you can't create your own world and stage manage the events in the way that you can if you're just writing a purely fictional story. So sometimes I did wonder exactly what to do with the real historical characters when they came into contact with my fictional plot line, because I do have a murder mystery based on events that never happened. With respect to the legal plot line and the Supreme Court cases and what happened to the Japanese Americans and what happened inside the Justice Department and inside the War Department as all of these government agencies were fighting over the appropriate answer, I tried to make that as accurate as I could. And generally speaking, when my real historical characters are doing things that aren't purely made up, that aren't part of my murder mystery, they do what they really did and they say what they really said or wrote in their diary or wrote in a letter. Most of what they say they actually really said. I tried to be accurate there, and when I couldn't be accurate, I tried to be fair. So I did a lot of research on these people and I tried to get a pretty good sense of who they were and what they were like, and I did my best to show them acting as they might have been expected to act in the slightly altered circumstances that I created.
I wonder about how you relate to your own family history in writing something like this. I mean, you are both on the inside of it and have probably a family history that is private. I would hope you do. But that also is very public and scrutinized and has a historical narrative of its own. And how do you place yourself in that in a way that is honest?
Well, in one sense, I think maybe it made me feel a little bit more freedom in writing about actual historical figures because my historical figure ancestors have been turned into fiction. And I don't object to that. I think that's fine. I think it's great to imaginatively reconstruct parts of their lives. So I felt maybe a little bit of license to do that with other historical figures to whom I'm not related. With FDR in particular, though, who is a relative, I thought that it's important to understand that good people can do bad things. So FDR, I think, was a great president, and I think he was a good man, and I think he had more empathy than you might have expected from someone of his social class and background at the time. But with the Japanese Americans in World War II, he just failed. He didn't care enough about their interests. He didn't care enough about the hardship that was being inflicted on them. And the reason for that, I think, is that he trusted the people who were giving him advice because they were people like him. And a big point that I was trying to bring out with all of that was you can't assume that people are trustworthy because they're like you. You can't assume that because they went to the right schools and they talk the right way and they look the right way that they actually know what's best. And I think FDR was led astray by his trust of people like him, and he didn't care enough to look into it himself. He didn't care enough to try to really figure out whether there was a problem of disloyalty in the Japanese American population, which in fact there wasn't.
So since we've brought up FDR, some of our listeners may not be aware of all the details, but tell us about Executive Order 9066, and which I believe was what allowed a lot of this to get set into motion.
Yes, Executive Order 9066 was an order FDR issued which authorized a general named John DeWitt, who was in charge of the Western Defense Command, which was basically the Pacific Coast states. It authorized him to exclude from those states any persons he deemed necessary. And on its face, it says nothing about race, but it was understood by everyone at the time that what was going to happen then was the Japanese and Japanese American community was going to be forced to leave those states. And that order didn't come out of nowhere. It's not something that FDR thought up and drafted on his own. It actually came after a long struggle between different agencies in the government, notably the War Department, which was in favor, and the Justice Department, which was opposed. So another person who maybe could have stopped this, FDR is one. Another person who maybe could have stopped this is FDR's Attorney General Francis Biddle, who is from Philadelphia. In fact, the Penn Law Library is named for him, the Biddle Law Library. And he thought this was wrong. He was never a supporter of removing and detaining the Japanese Americans. But he also was not willing to take a strong enough stand against Washington establishment figures who had similar educational and class backgrounds. So he went along with this in the end, even though for a while there was a pretty serious clash between the War Department and the Justice Department.
And Biddle plays a strong role in the book, and that conflict is there. And he is somebody who, I have to say, the name seemed familiar, but I didn't have a direct knowledge of, oh, who is this guy? Yet he really does play a significant role in our modern history, as do the justices that you feature in the book, Frankfurter and Hugo Black as well. And it must have been kind of fun to play with all of these people and have them serve your narrative purposes in a way.
It was amazing to learn as much as I learned about them, because I did have an anxiety about being fair and being accurate. So I did an enormous amount of research. So for basically every historical character, I read a biography, at least one when there was available, even minor characters who were only in one scene. And then for the justices, I typically read several biographies, autobiographies if they existed. For Hugo Black, there's a memoir by his son, which I read. And it was really an amazing process of coming to get to know these people and to understand why they did what they did. And I tried to portray as sympathetically as I could even the people on the bad side, because one thing that I think it's very important for us to understand is no one thinks they're the bad guys. You mentioned this earlier. A phrase that recurs through the book is, we're the good guys. And everyone who says that is sincere. they're saying, of course, we're the good guys. You're one of us. Come along. And then Cash has to decide who really are the good guys.
When we were off mic, you were talking about meeting somebody yesterday, the daughter of – was it the daughter?
The daughter of Fred Korematsu.
Yeah. And Fred Korematsu and Mitsuye Endo were people who had cases brought forth before the Supreme Court and are central in your book as well. Could you maybe give our listeners a little bit of – background on that or what those cases were about and the implications of them?
So there are three big Supreme Court cases about the rights of the Japanese Americans. One is about a curfew. It's a case called Hirabayashi. And in that case, the Supreme Court said it was okay to impose a curfew on Japanese and Japanese American residents of the West Coast. This is before they were forced to leave. Then there's a case about the exclusion orders where the army says to these people, you must leave the state, you must leave your homes. That's the Korematsu case. And in that case, the Supreme Court said it's okay. It's a reasonable measure for national security. It's a reasonable way to promote national security if you consider the burden imposed on these people and compare it to the safety gain. It's a reasonable choice to do this. And that was wrong. It was not reasonable because there was no safety gain and the hardship was enormous. But Korematsu as a decision has never been overruled. So it's still out there. One of the dissenters said this decision lies about like a loaded gun waiting for the next person, the next president to come along and pick it up and use it to commit another injustice. And to a certain extent, I think that's true. There's a danger of that. And, you know, it's there in the rhetoric that we hear now from some of the presidential candidates. So Fred Korematsu quite admirably, spent much of his life after World War II working for civil liberties and trying to ensure that we don't repeat the mistakes of the past. He participated as a friend of the court in some of the post-September 11th war on terror litigation. There's a Fred Korematsu Institute, which is designed to promote historical awareness and prevent us from doing this sort of thing again. And Karen Korematsu is very active in that effort too. Then the last case, the Endo case, is where the Supreme Court actually considered detention in camps. And this is something that most people don't know. I think most people think the Supreme Court just upheld the program in its entirety. But actually, in that case, the Supreme Court said, without some reason to doubt the loyalty of a specific individual, without some reason more than race, the government cannot confine them in a camp. So there you can see the Supreme Court was sort of trying to do the right thing. If you look at these decisions, the Supreme Court was clearly conflicted. They were unhappy with what the government was doing. They didn't want to interfere with the war effort. But in the Endo case, I think they tried to stand up to the extent they could for civil liberties.
And these cases play a central role in the book. And Cash, the main character, he, because he doesn't pass his physical to serve in the war effort, begins clerking for Hugo Black. And you were a Supreme Court clerk, yes?
Yes, I was. I clerked for Justice Souter.
And from the book, it sounds like they have a lot of power, or that's maybe how it was portrayed. But is that the case? I mean, do the clerks have the ability to actually advocate cases and even write decisions?
Well, the clerks certainly have the ability to talk to their justices about the cases. And I think many, if not most, clerks go into the job thinking, I'll be there helping the justice make the decision and maybe I'll change his or her mind. In fact, I think that happens very rarely. There have historically been a couple of justices maybe who were suggestible enough to be persuaded by their clerks. Frank Murphy, who's a character, a justice in the novel, is maybe one of those. And I do suggest that that happened a couple of times. I don't think that Hugo Black was, so I don't have characters changing the minds of their justices in ways that I think are not historically supported. In my experience clerking, it really didn't happen. I think if I had been able to show Justice Souter that he was wrong about something, he certainly would have changed his mind, but I simply wasn't ever able to do that. And generally speaking, the clerks don't have that much influence over the actual decisions that the justices make. They do have some influence perhaps over the cases that the court hears, because that's an area where a fair amount of the responsibility does fall to the clerks in the first instance. And it might be the case that a clerk could either bury some case that the justices might have wanted to hear if they had heard about it properly, or maybe a clerk could agitate in favor of a particular case and make it more likely that the justices would hear it.
And playing tennis with a Supreme Court judge?
That's actually – so that happens in the book, Cash Plays Tennis with Hugo Black. That's a part of the book that was drawn from my own experience, because while I was clerking on the Supreme Court, I played tennis with Justice Scalia. He regularly played with his clerks, but one week the clerk he played with had hurt his ankle playing basketball, so I substituted in. And my description of Justice Black's tennis game, it's drawn from history to the extent I could, because he did write about it some. He talked about it. He wrote about it in his letters. But where I couldn't figure out how he played, I actually filled it in with Justice Scalia's tennis game.
Has he read the book?
I don't know.
Maybe he'll recognize himself.
If I see him, I'll ask him about it.
I'm talking with Kermit Roosevelt. The book is Allegiance. It's a historical fiction that, if you don't know a lot about the Japanese internment in World War II, it can educate you about that and also be a good read as well, because there's a little bit of a love story type stuff and a murder mystery and coming of age for this young man. Kermit, what's ahead for you aside from your legal career or your writing and your teaching? Can we look for another novel from you?
Absolutely. I'm going to try to get the next one out a little bit faster than this one. Actually, it was really 10 years between my first and second novel. I spent 8 years working on this. In part, that was because there was a lot of research to do, and I did research it very carefully. In part also, that was because my wife and I had two kids along the way, which slowed things down a lot. So I'm hoping that I can get the next novel out a little bit faster.
Kids do slow you down just a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
And do you have political aspirations, or maybe you just don't know about that, or further legal aspirations?
I don't think I have political aspirations, not for elected office. I think that the process of campaigning and even the way our campaign finance system works now, the process of governing is so driven by money and big donors that it's a terrible process. I really wouldn't want to put myself through it.
Well, keep writing books. Thank you for coming in today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Nice talking. My conversation with Kermit Roosevelt on his most recent historical fiction, Allegiance. Let's take a short break, and when we return, we'll visit with Larry Hendricks, a Sonoma County resident, retired Oakland firefighter, and driving force behind Random Acts, an organization whose mission is to help fellow firefighters along with the communities they serve. Fort Minor is the solo persona of hip-hop artist Mike Shahoda of Linkin Park, and he created this piece, Kenji. Shahoda's father was interned during World War II, and this piece describes the experience with excerpts of conversation with his dad and aunt mixed into the cut. Of the internment, he said, "It'd be your average neighbor, or you, getting pulled out of your house because you were racially profiled as somebody dangerous."
My father came from Japan in 1905. He was 15 when he immigrated from Japan. He worked until he was able to actually build a store.
Let me tell you a story in the form of a dream. I don't know why I have to tell it, but I know what it means. Close your eyes, just picture the scene as I paint it for you. It was World War II when this man named Kenji woke up. Ken was not a soldier.
He was just a man with a family who owned a store in L.A. That day, he crawled out of bed like he always did, bacon and eggs with wife and kids. He lived on the second floor of a little store he ran. He moved to L.A. from Japan. They called him immigrant. In Japanese, he'd say he was called Issei. That meant first generation in the United States, when everybody was afraid of the Germans, afraid of the Japs, but most of all, afraid of a homeland attack. And that morning, when Ken went out on the doormat, his world went black, 'cause right there, front page news, 3 weeks before 1942, Pearl Harbor's been bombed and the Japs are coming. Pictures of soldiers dying and running. Ken knew what it would lead to, just like he guessed. The president said the evil Japanese in our home country would be locked away. They gave Ken a couple of days to get his whole life packed in two bags. Just two bags, couldn't even pack his clothes. Some folks didn't even have a suitcase to pack anything in, so two trash bags is all they gave them. And when the kids asked Mom, where are we going, nobody even knew what to say to them. Ken didn't want to lie, he said the U.S. is looking for spies, so we have to live in a place called Mandanar, where a lot of Japanese people are. Stop it, don't look at the gunmen. You don't want to get the soldiers wondering if you're gonna run or not, because if you run, then you might get shot. Other than that, try not to think about it. Try not to worry about it being so crowded. But someday we'll get out. Someday, someday.
As soon as war broke out, so the FBI came, and they just come to the house, and you have to come. All the Japanese have to go. They took Mr. Nee. The people couldn't understand why they had to take him, because he's an innocent laborer.
So now they're in a town with soldiers surrounding them. Every day, every night, look down at them. From watchtowers up on the wall, Ken couldn't really hate them at all. They were just doing the job, and he wasn't gonna make any problems. He had a little garden, vegetables and fruits that he gave to the troops in a basket his wife made. But in the back of his mind, he wanted his family's life saved. Prisoners of war in their own damn country, what for? And time passed in the prison town. He wondered if he'd live it down, if and when they were free. The only way out was joining the army. And supposedly, some men went out for the army, signed on, and ended up flying to Japan with a bomb. That 15 kiloton blast put an end to the war pretty fast. Two cities were blown to bits. The end of the war came quick, and Ken got out, big hopes of a normal life with his kids and his wife. But then they got back to their home, and what they saw made him feel so alone. These people had trashed every room, smashed in the windows and bashed in the doors, written on the walls and the floor, "Japs not welcome anymore." And Kenji dropped both of his bags at his sides and just stood outside. He looked at his wife without words to say. She looked back at him, wiping tears away, and said, "Someday we'll be okay, someday." Now the names have been changed, but the story's true. My family was locked up back in 42. My family was there where it was dark and damp, and they called it an internment camp.
When we first got back from camp, it was pretty bad.
I remember my husband said, "Are we going to stay till last?" Then my husband died before they closed the camp.
You're listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea. I'm Suzanne Lang, and we just heard Fort Minor, a.k.a. Mike Shinoda, and his piece, Kenji. During this past fall of wildfire in California, over 30 people who work daily in the fire service lost their own homes, notably in the Valley Fire in Lake County and the Butte Fire in Calaveras County. The fire family is a strong one, and Larry Hendricks is one of their own. A musician and retired Oakland firefighter, Larry's energy is only matched by the size of his heart. He's the driving force behind the Oakland Firefighters Random Acts, a nonprofit organization devoted to giving back to firefighters and the communities they serve. Random Acts has partnered with the Fire Family Foundation to support those firefighters who have lost so much. Here's our conversation. Larry Hendricks, welcome.
Thank you.
You are with Oakland Firefighters Random Acts. And before we talk about that organization and other organizations and how that relates to the recent Valley Fire, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself so we know a little bit about you?
Well, I've lived in Sebastopol for 20 years. I was an Oakland firefighter for 30. And I do a lot of different things. I've been a musician my entire life, and I'm blessed to live in Sebastopol and enjoy a lot of the area. But yeah, my life's kind of been about giving back, and I'm really enjoying what I'm able to do.
And that giving back is something you do through Random Acts. Why don't you tell us about that organization, Oakland Firefighters Random Acts, and maybe a little bit about how that organization got started and some of the good work they do?
Well, in August of 2000, a very diverse group of Oakland firefighters created a standalone 501c3 nonprofit. We separated from the city, the union, the fire administration. But they all support us, but yet we're pretty much free to do what we want as far as helping people. Our main purpose is to raise money, and nobody gets a paycheck in our organization. And 100% of what we bring in goes out to empower firefighters, especially after a brutal 911 call, to go back and help the family, to get closure for the family and themselves, to create a good memory.
So it sounds like it's a little bit about what happens after an episode or an incident where there may be a home destroyed or an accident or something like that?
Well, there's a variety of things that happen, you know, as far as violence and other issues, or it runs the whole gamut. But firefighters across the United States, they all have memories. You know, that's a part of the job. They wish they didn't have, and they don't go away. So what we try to do is empower them to go back and create good memories to, you know, start stacking up the good ones. So when they retire, at least they have some good ones.
And what are some of the projects you have taken on as an organization?
2 years ago, we built about $100,000 firefighter-themed playground behind the family house at Children's Hospital. Most of that was donated, and so actually the cost came down to $43,000. But if you go to our website, you can actually see a picture of it. It's a scale model of the firehouse right down the street, Station 8 in Oakland. It's dedicated to two guys that passed 9 years ago from that station within 3 days of each other. And if you go into this little miniature firehouse, you'll see a ladder. And inside those rungs, there's pictures of these two guys that we lost when they were visiting the kids at Children's Hospital. Recently, we were blessed to get a grant from the NFL, one of only 50 organizations, for a program we call Random Acts of Science. It's a $60,000 production trailer where we actually can bring the planets to the playgrounds. It's a giant outdoor screen with a pretty amazing telescope where we can, through our video switching equipment and sound system, put the planets live or stars on the screen to educate the parents, though, more than the children, that if they get their kids up to Chabot Space and Science Center in Oakland and get involved in their Galaxy Explorer program, 100% of the kids go to college. But and the other one that we started originally, we launched this in 2006, it's a 1967 Van Pelt fire engine. We did about a $35,000 restoration. Actually, I rode on this engine as a new kid in 1983, but without a safety strap on the back when you just held on. But we've converted that into a 10-passenger parade vehicle. It has a generator and a massive DJ system on board. But yet, in an hour, all the modules change out and it becomes a hearse for our guys. We were so blessed last summer to lead the Warriors Victory Parade. That was pretty awesome. So there's the website is pretty expansive, and you know, you just don't have time for me to talk about everything. But if you go to the website, ofrandomacts.org, you can enjoy it. It'll warm your heart.
It also sounds like, from being an Oakland firefighter your entire career, that you experienced a lot of the racial divide and diversity, maybe in the firehouse, but also in the community, and that some of what you're doing is work to bridge that.
Well, every year in Oakland, over 1,000 children receive one or more Christmas packages wrapped with their name on it Many of those are delivered by firefighters' Santas that step off the engines and trucks across the city. We actually have autonomy with the city of Oakland as a 501c3, and we're allowed to use the fire engines, fire trucks to step into the community. So I would say we probably have the largest, most diverse group of firefighter Santas. There's probably 90 or 100 by now, but it's a very diverse group. So, yes.
And I think most of us know that firefighters and people involved in fire service always have the reputation of being a strong fraternity, a strong brotherhood, a strong family. And we can say sisterhood, too, because women are involved in firefighting at the same level as men. But recently, with the Valley Fire, the fires in Lake County and the fires in Calaveras County, the Butte Fire, firefighters have lost their homes, and I think you told me a statistic.
Well, this is the largest loss of firefighter housing since the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco, 147,000 acres in a very short piece of time.
Certainly, we've heard some of the stories of these firefighters who witnessed their own homes burning in the line of their duty and had to keep going through that. And now your organization and an organization in Southern California is stepping up to help these people. And why don't you tell us a little bit about the synergy between Random Acts and the
Fire Family Foundation.
Yeah, and what you're trying to build with all that.
We have a list at this point of 33 firefighters who lost their homes. Some were driving by their home on fire while they were on the way to put somebody else's fire out. Many found out after. Some were on the phone or texting trying to get their wives and children's out while they were fighting a fire someplace else simultaneously. But 33 firefighters. And what we're doing is the Fire Family Foundation is the charitable hand of the Firefighter First Credit Union. In Los Angeles, that's their main area. They have 32,000 members who are starting to contribute to this movement. So what we're doing now, we're working mainly through fire department union locals. And what we're doing is we're going to give each local $1,000 to get the ball rolling. A member of that union local will then make a phone call to one of the firefighters that we will assign to them. So that firefighter from that union local will then have a conversation with the firefighter that lost their home. And they will determine some of the needs, and then they will create a shopping list. And that firefighter and will create a team, and basically that fire family is going to go up for a visit. And it's much more. A lot of departments are, you know, everybody's saying they're going to do a lot more than the $1,000, but that one intimate conversation, firefighter to firefighter, is going to determine, and actually we're asking some of the chiefs and officers in those departments to be our spies. That will, you know, most of these guys and girls are, a lot of them are really proud, and you have to kind of let them know it's okay. Firefighters are used to, you know, to giving and not receiving. But at this point, I'm telling them, you know, you need to receive a little for a while, and then you'll be able to give more again. And that kind of strikes a chord with some people. But calling these individuals, I think, has been my paycheck to listen to their stories and start to imagine in my mind who I can connect them with, or, you know, some of the departments that have come on board. There's more departments coming on board, and Central Calaveras has been difficult because many of the firefighters up there, some were still trying to get power to run their wells to get water, and they're still, their own personal version of Hiroshima is right out the front door.
And here in Sonoma County, we've been tracking our neighbors so much in Lake County because it's been a devastating loss to that community, and that there are so many people involved in fire service who were also affected by that. Larry, what drives you? You've been retired now for a couple of years, yet you are throwing so much energy into this when you can certainly be sitting back and enjoying the bucolic nature of our West County.
Well, in the last 15 years, our organization has been able to accomplish a lot, mainly because we're pretty much free to do it. We have no constraints. And we've been blessed to have so many other adjuncts. We have a staff of attorneys. We have computer people and printing and graphics. Everybody does this for free for us. And we're really, you know, so proud that people have stepped up for us as well. But for me, it becomes pretty infectious after a while. Because for me and firefighters, it's not about the money. It's, you know, it's about memories. So in the last 15 years, I have a treasure trove of memories that nobody can take away. So it's just fun to have myself in a position in life where when I see something and I have the connections to put things together for people, it's very, it brings me joy.
I really appreciate all your good work for the community here and the larger community around the state of firefighters. So thanks so much, Larry.
No, thank you.
What can our listeners do to support those who risk their lives to support us? What can we do to give back to these firefighters?
Well, if everyone would go to our website, OF, like Oscar Frank, OF, Random Acts, RANDOMACTS.org, you'll see our main page. If you go down and click on the green Learn More button, you can get our a lot of the information. You can see the press conference on Channel 2. You can see the one we created. But you can get to the donation page as well. And here's the thing. 100% of these donations are going to be going through the Fire Family Foundation, who are in charge of the collections. And they're coming in from all over the state. The Fire Family is responding. But if anybody would like to donate, and let's let you know, 100% of these will go to the firefighters, but also to the communities. Our goal is also to empower the firefighters where we can to step back into their communities to help bring them back as well. So, yeah, donations are very appreciated. This is being seen as an example to the new kids in fire departments, what the fire family means. But yeah, we're looking forward to this.
So not just providing emotional and physical comfort really to these families who've literally lost everything. And when you have children, that becomes all the more challenging. But it sounds like, yes, you're trying to spread the notion of giving and giving back so that you who have gone through your entire career are encouraging those newer people involved in firefighting that there's more to it than just putting on the boots.
A firefighter badge is probably the most powerful tool for human change. It'll open any door. If you put us next to a politician, chances are most people will choose the firefighter. That position of trust is cherished, and, you know, we work on earning that hero worship constantly. But when we're able to step into the community, especially children, firefighters across our nation, a lot of them are pretty burned out for some of the things they've had to participate in. They get a little cranky and grisly, but none of them will ever deny a child.
Yes, something you and I talked about privately is that firefighters are used to saving lives, to putting out fires, or that's what we count on you to do. But in these type of situations that are rare, when we have a fire like the Valley Fire, but it must be really hard for those people who are generally on the front line of protecting us to essentially being evacuating themselves.
You're absolutely right. They're very resilient. I spoke to a gentleman yesterday whose family has been on Cobb Mountain since the 1800s. He lost his house, his mother's house, his grandparents' house are gone. He has a one-year-old. And but in it, you know, he's moving on. He's, you know, planning for the future, and he's not dwelling. And he's also working as a firefighter still. So he has that to deal with. And, you know, we hope we can connect him with a fire department that's going to respond and, you know, see what they can do for him.
Well, Larry, thanks so much for your good work and for spreading that around to many of us.
Thank you, Suzanne, for having me. Okay. You're very welcome.
Musician and Sonoma County resident Larry Hendricks of Oakland Firefighters Random Acts. Find out more at ofrandomacts.org. Earlier in the broadcast, we heard Kermit Roosevelt with his historical fiction set during World War II, Allegiance. We'll go out with some music from the Swiss group Gotthard. We've had production assistance from Sean Knight and Mark Prell. You can listen to our podcasts at krcb.org. Subscribe and listen through iTunes. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thanks for listening. It's a novel idea.
The road is long.